This week on Art on the Air features folklorist and educator Susan Eleterio, who has conducted fieldwork and exhibits with artists and arts organizations across the United States. Next, we have glass fusion artist Tom Soros, who has pioneered thin fusing that allows for creation of featherweight pieces without the loss of depth or detail. Our spotlight's on the Lake County Library's 3rd Annual Creative Arts Summit.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Lake County Public Library. They're going to discuss a great event coming up called the Creative Arts Summit. This is now going to be their 3rd year. It provides a space for creators to network, showcase their art, sell things. We have the Assistant Branch Manager, Kelly McDonald, and Assistant Librarian, Max Jackson. Welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, welcome. It's nice to meet you.
Wonderful to meet you as well.
Max, we'll toss it to you first because that's what we agreed to. And you can tell us the concept behind this and what to expect at the Creative Arts Summit.
The Creative Arts Summit, it's like you mentioned, it's a really great opportunity. We wanted to give a space for creators in our area, so it's open to all versions of creators. In the 3 years we've had it, we've had creative artists, creative writers, painters, sculptors, craftspeople that make small tchotchkes, jewelry makers, graphic artists, visual artists, all sorts of different people. And they come in and they are welcome to sell their art to all the visitors that come through to the library, as well as they come directly for the Creative Arts Summit. But we really wanted to promote the fact that we want them to network together to try and expand their own opportunities as well.
So, Max, is it only Lake County artists?
The basic idea is it is Lake County, but anyone who is interested and is willing to make the journey is more than welcome to participate. So we have had people from Porter County, Southern Illinois, even near or past the border of Michigan in past years. So Lake County, basically, but anyone nearby, the greater Chicagoland area.
So how many tables are able to participate? How many do you have room for?
Last year, we pretty much hit our max, so there will be about 35 tables.
Ooh, that's healthy.
So yeah, so there's a large number of creators for people to interact with.
That's a great networking room.
Yeah, it'll be on the main level of our library, so very open. Anyone that walks in immediately sees all the artists.
And what is the fee to have a table there?
Once the submission period is over, it's pretty standard. There is an early submission within the first 2 weeks of getting selected. You have 2 weeks for a $10 fee. After that, once we get closer to the actual date, it's $20 to register. Right.
Do you jury these people that are applying by any filter method, or is there anything like that goes on?
Yes. So we have a committee of, in the past years, it's 3 to 5 people that do sit down and go through all the submissions, myself and Kelly and some of our other staff members. We do jury it less on craft and how well we personally think the art is. Much more it's about variety and giving variety to visitors and the artists that are participating. So, for example, if we find that we have a lot of painters that are applying, we'll give more attention to get more authors or poets in there just to even it out. So it's a good mix of different arts that are being showcased.
So Kelly, how did it all start 3 years ago?
So this actually came about. Max was given the opportunity to take over for a different event that the library hosted called the Local Author Fair. And while that event was very successful, and we were able to showcase authors in the area, Max thought, and a lot of people agreed, that it would be nice to open it up to creators of all kinds rather than just authors. I know the library is obviously a place where books are found and we appreciate words, but we thought it'd be nice to get more of a reach in the community and see what else people had to offer.
It is, because our libraries are our treasures in our communities, and really good thinking, Max, on that. It's like so excellent to bring another dynamic to the library.
So how many people did you have attend last year that visited?
For actual visitors, it runs over the course of a Saturday afternoon. So altogether, we average about 170 to 200 people that come through.
Oh, that's a great number and everything like that. And so this is your third year doing it. Is this looking like it's going to be an annual event?
100%. The first year was definitely a proof of concept. But after last year, we got really good feedback and there was no opposition or critiques from our higher ups or administration. They pretty much expect it. So unless something drastic happens this year, it seems like this is going to be an ongoing thing.
Excellent. Do you ever think about expanding it to maybe 2 times a year or some variation of that?
We actually have. Last year, we definitely kind of put it on the back burner just to see how things are going to turn out. But we get a lot of applicants that we definitely have to go through with a fine-tooth comb. So we definitely get more than enough people that we could expand it.
Excellent.
Across seasons.
Well, that's great. And I know I attended last year, and you had a wide variety of things. In fact, we got quite a few guests that came on the show here to talk about their art and everything like that. Well, in our last few moments here, we want to give you a chance to tell us about dates and times when the event actually occurs.
Sure. So anyone who's interested in attending, the Arts Fair is going to be, or the Arts Summit, I should say, is going to be June 1st from noon to 4 at the Maryville Branch, 1919 West 81st Avenue. We'd love to see everybody.
That's great. We appreciate coming on Art in the Air Spotlight and sharing about the Creative Arts Summit. And again, that's June 1st, 12 to 4 p.m. at the Maryville Branch on the main level. Thank you, Kelly McDonald and Max Jackson, for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And a Spotlight Extra. The Duneland Photography Club's upcoming exhibit, Summertime, is running May 28th to June 27th with an artist reception on Friday, June 7th at 5 p.m. located at Valparaiso's Art Barn School of Art, 695 North 400 East. Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art in the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
Art on the Air is pleased to announce that it received a 2024 Communicator Award of Distinction for its Episode 212, an interview with public media music theme composer B.J. Lederman. Thank you for listening to Art on the Air.
This is Curtis L. Chrysler, Poet Laureate of Indiana, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Susan Eleuterio to Art on the Air. Sue is a professional folklorist, educator, author, and consultant to nonprofits. She teaches courses in academic writing, organizing communities, and advocacy, activism, and social justice and fundraising. She has conducted fieldwork and developed public programs, including exhibits, performance, and folk arts education, including workshops and residencies in schools, along with professional development programs for teachers, students, adults, and artists in schools, museums, arts, education agencies, and arts organizations across the United States. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Sue. It's very nice meeting you, finally.
Likewise. Thank you, Esther.
Well, Sue, glad to have you on the show, and glad to also have you on the board for Lakeshore Public Media. So happy to have you on there and everything. You bring a whole new perspective to us. But we want to find out about Sue. I always like to say your origin story. I tee it up by saying how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Sue.
Well, I was born in Michigan, so I am a Midwesterner by birth, but I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. Went to the University of Delaware and thought I was going to be an English teacher and was in Future Teachers of America. But I graduated in the mid-70s and there weren't a lot of teaching jobs. And I, on a lark, had applied for an internship at a museum in Delaware, the Hagley Museum, which is where the DuPont Company started, working with inner city kids. That had always been an interest of mine, working with kids who were coming from the inner city. So I did that for a year, and then I still didn't know what I wanted to do, like a lot of people in their 20s. And I had applied in college to be a VISTA volunteer, which is the predecessor for AmeriCorps. And I had a thing about Chicago, and I can't tell you why, because I had never been to Chicago, but maybe hearing my mother talk about it. So at the time, you could specify where you wanted to go, and I got a telegram the day of my sister's wedding saying I had 5 days to decide if I wanted to go to Chicago. So I did. And I worked for Thresholds, which is a rehab agency for people who've been hospitalized with mental health issues. And that made it clear to me that I was not cut out to do social work. It was a very intense. It was when institutions were being de-warehoused, which was a good thing. But it was... it was an intense experience, and I had a mentor at the museum I had worked at who had gone to the Cooperstown Graduate Program, which is a small graduate program in upstate New York as part of SUNY Oneonta, and I decided I wanted to go into museum education. When I got to my interview, one of the things that happened in college is I took my first folklore course. And I researched the songs that my grandmother sang, which are fados, which are Portuguese blues. And when the director of the program heard about that, he said, you want to be a folklorist. And I wanted to get into grad school. So I said, sure. So I ended up with a master's in American folk culture and a minor in museum studies, which was great because I have alternated doing museum work and folklore work ever since.
Well, do you think like these folklorist beginnings for all of us kind of begin in childhood? We had all those jumping rope rhymes, Ring Around the Rosie and London Bridges. So did you love mythology and fairy tales and folklore from childhood? Do you?
It's an interesting question. I did love fairy tales. I was a voracious reader. We used to go to the public library in the little elementary school near my house, and you were only really supposed to take out one book at a time, but I talked the librarian into five books at a time because they only open once a week in the summer. I think it was partly that. It was also, I think, having a dad who was from an immigrant background. My father was the child of Portuguese immigrants, and he didn't learn English till he went to grade school. And having an unusual last name also means that you're always having to explain yourself. So I was always interested in culture. I think that's part of it.
What is a folklorist? You kind of described some of it so far, but maybe give us a definition. And there may be varieties and everything, but kind of explore that for our audience.
Yes. What I always say is we are a lot like anthropologists, but anthropologists tend to study systems. So they look at an entire structure of culture. And we are really interested in the individuals and the traditions that they carry. And that's really the difference between us and most anthropologists now. Anthropologists and folklorists have kind of, and historians, frankly, have all gotten closer and closer to each other's interests over the years. And we really are pretty multidisciplinary. But my interest and what I studied in graduate school was specifically material culture, which is stuff. So everything from clothing to gardens to, you know, what's the entrance everybody uses in your house. And I've remained interested in that, and also have taught urban legends over the years. And a lot of my work has been with traditional artists.
What sort of way?
So because I had that education background, I knew a lot about school culture, which is its own particular culture, by the way. Every school has culture of it. Specific culture, both formal and informal. And so I got a job in Chicago with Urban Gateways, which is an arts education agency. And they wanted to start bringing, they were already bringing fine artists into the schools, but they wanted to bring traditional artists in. So that was one of my first jobs in folklore, was identifying traditional artists, one of whom is Billy Branch, who's a blues musician. And Billy is still doing blues in the schools over 40 years later. So I'll take a little credit for that. And what I've done over the years with traditional artists is to help them develop curriculum, and also how to develop residencies and workshops in schools that fit, again, into that school culture.
So as part of the humanities, this is kind of a unique probably branch of humanities. You've taught and you've done things like that over the years, but what are some of the other areas that maybe you have not explored that you would like to explore in folklore?
That's a great question. Well, I have a 30-year project, Larry, that started because my first husband was Irish-American, and I used to take my kids to Irish-American events. And I got interested in the costumes in particular, back to that material culture interest. And at the time, the lace cuffs and collars were still being handmade by mothers in Chicago. I also started getting to know a little bit about Mexican-American folk dance, partly through my work. At one point, I was the director of ethnic and folk arts for the Illinois Arts Council. And I got to know the Mexican Folkloric Dance Company of Chicago. And I got interested in the parallels between the Irish and the Mexicans in Chicago and in the Midwest, in terms of being groups that were often denigrated when they first came and marginalized, and at the same time had these really interesting historic traditions of using costume and dance and music to celebrate their independence from colonial, you know, so in the case of Mexican Americans, colonial Spain, and in the case of the Irish, the English. So I've been researching that for a long time, and I really want to do a book and an exhibit. And what I would love to do is have the Irish costumes at the Mexican Fine Arts Museum and the Mexican costumes at the Irish American Heritage Center, because I think it would be so interesting for folks to realize how many parallels there are.
It's so true. It's uniting, though. Music and costumes and all those traditions unite us. And so with that in mind, though, what happens like in place? So you grow up, and sometimes we grow up near other families. So some of those folk traditions are just absorbed naturally. But what about the child that moves around? Like, how does folk traditions, how does that shift? Because, you know, you join a new neighborhood and you join a new community. So how does that track?
So it's a great question. It's really interesting because Americans do move a lot. And often when I first started studying this in the 70s, there was this sense that we were going to lose everything if we didn't hurry up and document it, right? And the fascinating thing to me is that folk culture has continued in spite of the internet, I mentioned urban legends. So interestingly enough, there's almost more belief now in things like urban legends than there than there was before the internet, because things get passed so easily. And the definition of an urban legend, with the father of urban legends, John Brunvon, said that it's always from a friend of a friend. So what happens is it's always just removed enough that you don't really know all the facts. And if it sounds believable, you believe it and you pass it on. So that's one example of something that's really universal. They're found all over the world. The other things that continue no matter where you go are things like how you got your name, or and often you'll realize that there might be something you weren't even aware of was a folk tradition. So, for instance, my mother was a Michigan farm girl. My dad was a New England child of immigrants. When my mother was growing up, the only time you saw an orange in Michigan was if you got it in your Christmas stocking. But we always had oranges, and that turned out to be a Portuguese tradition, you know, that you had to have citrus fruit. So things like that are really, you know, one of the things I do when I work in schools is try to convince the teachers that they have folk culture as well, because there's often that sense that you mentioned, Esther, well, I'm just an American, I don't have any traditions. But then when you start exploring it, everybody has something.
Could even be a fragrance, you know, like the fragrance of my grandmother's cooking, you know, just
folklore. It seems like that language is strongly tied to that, and maybe the loss of languages, or even of, you know, like sub languages, you know, like different types of accents and things like that, is tied to that. So respond to that. Is that something like preserving, like, I know, like the Tambaritsans, for example, they preserve a lot of the, not only European dances and songs and things like that, because in our country that's lost, but how do you feel language is really tied to the folklore?
It's a major component of it. And again, we're often unaware of things that we've absorbed that may be a language tradition. So there may be ways of speaking. And interestingly enough, I'm an adjunct faculty at Goucher College in Maryland in the Master's in Cultural Sustainability. And that's a lot of what our program is about, is helping students learn and study and document and help others preserve their culture. And I had a deaf student I had her in the class, and then I also was her capstone advisor. And one of the things she taught me that was so fascinating is, in deaf culture, you get a name that describes often your physical characteristics, and it's different from your legal name. And a lot of researchers don't know that. So when she researches historic deaf communities, when people research deaf communities, they often miss that piece of it. And she also taught me just things about sign language and deaf language and deaf culture. For instance, when you talk about the past, there's a sign that indicates the past. So if you're doing grammatically, it you don't say she went to the store. You kind of show that she went to the store, that it is past tense. So I just think that there's so much richness in language. And I think it's interesting that you asked about accents, because I know even when I was, when I first moved to the Midwest, there was this assumption, right, that everybody was losing their accents. But I can tell a New Yorker, New Jersey, Philadelphia person from little things, like in Delaware and Southern Jersey and Philly, we say we go down the shore. We don't say we go to the beach. So there's these little things. And it is funny, because my mother, being a Michigander, didn't want us to have a Delaware accent. So she really didn't let us talk like Delawareans. But when I moved out here, and then I spent a year in Wisconsin working with Norwegian immigrants at Old World Wisconsin. I was writing a research exhibit plan for their Norwegian exhibit. So I talked to all these Norwegians. So when I moved back to Chicago, I had that touch of East Coast, and then I had a bit of the rounded vowels of the Norwegian accent. So people in Chicago were sure I was from Canada. So, you know, again, we're not even aware a lot of times what's influencing us and what's influencing our language, but it's still happening, you know.
Yeah, the whole language, like even in our own state of Indiana here, how at least three distinct languages. There's, we exist in what we call the Northern Midland accent. And of course, the region also has strong influence from Chicago. And then there's sort of the Mid-Midland accent. And as you approach the Ohio River, it becomes a South Midland accent. Across the Ohio River, it's completely different too. So,
absolutely. And of course, you know, up here, we talk about the region. And you have to know what the region is.
You know? Tell us about some of the courses that you do teach in folklore. Both you touched on a couple, but you know some of the aspects of that, and also your research.
So my research has been in a whole variety of things. I've done a lot of food research, mostly because I have a friend, Lucy Long, who's a folklorist in Ohio, and she's an expert in what we call food waste, speaking of language. And so I did a chapter for a book she was writing on comfort food. She wanted to include a diner, and I spend a lot of time in Hyde Park, and the Valois Cafeteria is where former President Barack Obama spent a lot of his time. So I also was a workshop leader for 10 years, a volunteer workshop leader with the Neighborhood Writing Alliance in Chicago, and all of my writers were from the South Side, and all but one of them were African-American. So we co-wrote about tradition, food, and politics at the Valois Cafeteria. And it's a really interesting place because its motto is "See Your Food." And one of the things I learned is that when cafeterias first opened, Black people, African-American people, were not that used to being able to go to restaurants, sadly, right? So there was this suspicion, frankly, about how people were going to treat you when you went to a restaurant. So Valois' motto is "See Your Food," and you can. And when you go to the cafeteria, they're making their food, the food right in front of you, and you walk along the line and get your food. And that was one of the reasons that cafeteria has been so successful in Hyde Park for years and years and years. So I've written about Portuguese food. I've also written about foodways in a variety of places that where there are descendants of Portuguese. In terms of teaching, what I teach now is I teach advocacy that Esther mentioned. I teach a course in advocacy and organizing for cultural communities. So how can cultural communities learn to use the tools of advocacy and organizing to protect their traditions? I also teach fundraising, which I have to say is fairly popular with my students, and I teach academic writing. And the other things I've written, I wrote a guide to Irish American material culture. That's another one of those. A friend of mine was editing a series of books on material culture, and she wasn't going to do the Irish. And I'm just a little Irish, but I got my Irish up. And she said, "Well, I don't think they have any material culture." So I set out to prove her wrong. And was able to publish a book on festivals and sites and collections of Irish American material culture in the United States.
Well, so on a lighter note, going back to comfort food. So are your comfort foods cultural, or are they not? Just, you know,
it's a great
question. It's so interesting.
Well, yeah. So one of them for sure is Portuguese sweetbread, which I learned to make from my grandmother, which is, it's a very sweet bread. That's a good question. What are my other comfort foods? I've become, actually, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the cookbook, Who's Your Mama? Mm-hmm. Pies. It is one of the best pie cookbooks. And it's funny because actually the Who's Your Mama place is in Chicago, but they have great pie recipes. So my husband loves pies. So that's become one of our comfort foods.
Is there something outside of folklore that you would like to pursue, whether, and I guess I'd say this, Sue, what do you do for fun that's not folklore?
So I love bike riding, and a friend of mine actually in Indiana a couple years ago had a niece who had leukemia, so she started bike riding to raise money for the Leukemia Lymphoma Society. So I have completed a number of 100-mile bike rides. I have to get back in training this year. I haven't done it for a year or two. But I love bike riding. And if you're a bike rider, one of the rides I did was around Lake Tahoe, which is called America's Most Beautiful Bike Ride. And it really is pretty spectacular.
And I like to garden.
Oh, and I am a beekeeper. Yes. And I'm a beekeeper. So that's my other big hobby is a friend of mine took a class a few years back and I got interested, and I just, bees, I could talk about bees more than my five grandchildren.
Any projects you have that you are ready to start, whether in folklore or in your field at all, as down the road?
Well, the dance costume one is the one I really want to finish.
Yeah.
Well, it's just totally me. That's the problem, Esther, is I don't have anybody yell at me, but I just, a group of folklorist friends of mine, we have a Midwestern folklorist and culture workers group that's all Midwestern folklorists and people who work in culture. And we just formed a writing group literally this week where we're going to stay on each other's case to get our writing done. So I have hopes for that.
Excellent.
You recently joined the Lakeshore Public Media Board, of course, that I am on too, and bring some of the things. But you also work in nonprofit fundraising. Tell us briefly about your background in doing that.
Well, my husband Tom Sorlis started Grants Inc., which lasted for 10 years and which was designed to help grassroots organizations in Northwest Indiana learn grant writing and fundraising skills. And it ran for 10 years, and I learned a lot about fundraising, just why I can teach it now. And I'm also on the board of Kind Folk, which is an organization in southern Indiana that also works across the border. So with Kentuckiana, it's a young folklorist who does education programs. And I'm on the board of Southern Ohio Folklife, and we do research, especially into Latinx culture in Southern Ohio.
Well, you know, unfortunately, we're running out of time here, Sue. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show and sharing your whole journey in folklore and other things. And is there any way people can find out more about you, like on the internet or such?
I do have a profile on LinkedIn, and there's only one Susan E. Luterio that I know of. And I'm on Facebook and Instagram.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air Spotlight. That's Sue Eleuterio, and she's a folklorist extraordinaire, and she shared her whole journey with us. Thank you so much for sharing your life journey on Art in the Air.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you, Sue. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Art in the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners. Email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. Our show relies on the support of not only our show underwriters, but also our listeners who make donations to this station. Your support of this station will ensure Art in the Air may continue bringing you the best of the arts and culture programming for Northwest Indiana and beyond. If Art in the Air is important to you, please consider supporting this station with a one-time contribution or even making an ongoing sustaining contribution. For information on how to make a contribution, go to this station's website or our show website, breck.com/AOTA. And thank you.
This is Mary Clark, the author of Dandelion Roots Run Deep, and you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Tom Sorlis to Art on the Air. Tom has pursued a lifelong interest in the arts and crafts through weaving, painting, and flat glasswork. He studied architecture, learned tuck pointing from his father, founded Sorlis Masonry Restoration, and in 1992 invented MortarNet, which in 2013 garnered the North Indiana Society of Innovators Award. In 1974, he began making stained glass windows and lampshades, and his working with glass has evolved over the last 50 plus years. He is also a lifelong gardener and avid athlete, founding the Gary Rugby Club in 1973. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Tom. It's very nice seeing you again.
Same here, Esther. Thank you for having me.
Well, Tom, welcome to Art in the Air. We always like to find out from our guests their origin story. While Esther covered some of that in the intro, we want to hear it from you. We always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So, Tom, tell us about yourself.
Well, I was born in Gary in 1947 and stayed in Gary most of my life. Moved to Highland eventually in 76. Growing up, I was always interested in making things. You know, from birdhouses to plastic models to forts in the backyard or whatever. And that stayed with me my entire life. I've had a lot of interests, such as the gardening and sports and such. but I always wanted to spend more time on art. And now that I'm retired, I'm finally doing that. My time is spent primarily with grandkids, gardening and glasswork. I've sold my business and free to do what I please. So it's really enjoyable at this point. Esther mentioned that I'd studied architecture, and that also boosted my skill set and my understanding of the arts and such.
What about early schooling, like growing up in your household, elementary school, middle school, high school? What was your art experience?
I had the good fortune to have an extended family in our home. My father bought a building on Tyler Street that had three kitchenettes, a bedroom, and a bathroom upstairs. And throughout my childhood, I had my grandparents lived upstairs. My uncle on their side lived upstairs, and four aunts and two uncles from the other side of the family came and went upstairs. So it was an extremely busy house, and it was wonderful. As kids, we got pretty spoiled because we spent time with each of them. And it was lots of eyes on you. yeah, that too. We spent a lot of time outdoors, my brother and I and our friends. And we had a duneland area just a few houses down. It was separated from the rest of the city by the Wabash Railroad tracks and the what we call the High Line, which is an elevated line. I forget which railroad ran it. It might have been the J, but it went into the mills and served at the mills. So there was this wild area that we played in constantly in our childhood. And a lot, as I said, I mentioned building forts and such. And all of that stuff really kind of got into me and stayed there. I still really enjoy putzing around the yard and getting out and reshaping the garden and all the things you do as a gardener, constant weeding. So in high school, I was a pretty typical high school student, played sports, dealt with being a teenager, had pretty fair grades, and went on to college. And I couldn't decide between being a veterinarian or an architect, and the opportunity came along to apply to IIT in Chicago, and I did. And I ended up with a wrestling scholarship there. And stayed until I was ready to go into my fifth year, at which point I realized that I was really not suited for architecture, I think mainly because it was always indoors and such. So I quit school. I went into Vista. Vietnam was raging at that time, and I was firmly against it. So went into Vista for 2 years. That was a wonderful experience. Worked with seasonal farm workers in New York State building self-help housing. Mm-hmm. And then left there and came back to Gary in 73, at which point I started the rugby club, which I had learned to play at Brockport State University in New York. And continued playing that most of my life, probably well past the time I should have. But I loved it and loved sports. Played a little pickleball, wonderful game. And as I said, now it's glass gardening and grandkids pretty much full time.
The glass come in?
The glass, 1974. There was a renaissance in the late 60s and early 70s in the glass, stained glass world. Tiffany lamps were rediscovered. Before that, you could buy an authentic Tiffany lamp, I'm talking about here. For 50 to 100 bucks in a junk shop in the 1950s. And then the 60s came around and things started to change and people became aware of arts more, I think. And Tiffany lamps became the item, and hence stained glass became popular. And I took a liking to it. So I started with flat glass doing Tiffany lamps using the copper foil and solder method, and enjoyed that quite a bit. And after about 20 years of that, discovered fusing. And fusing is really my spot. It's much faster and freer than stained glass work, much more expressive in its details. And it's a lot, it's very much like painting because we work primarily with powders right now. And if you think about painting, all the paintings are, you're moving powders around that are suspended in a liquid, maybe oils, maybe water, acrylics, but there's, you're still painting with powders, and we're using the powders dry. So we shape them with brushes and tweezers and sticks and just about anything we can come up with to form all sorts of very small and thin objects, flower petals, the stamens, brackets, stems, everything that goes into a flower, for instance. We make those all separately and individually, and then we combine them into to make panels and lampshades, primarily lampshades. I've had a fascination with the lamps since experiencing my first Tiffany exposure in the early 1970s.
So, Tom, when I first saw your work, I'm not sure that I had seen the techniques that you were using really anywhere else, especially these components that you make, these delicate, delicate components that then get fused into the glass. It seems like you took fusing in a, you know, a very unique direction. They're just exquisite. And the video that you have on, you know, where Twyla's making the components yeah. is just so beautiful.
It's very engaging, isn't it, to watch those develop out of a small pile of powder.
Right. And I've seen it. And then, you know, I'm very familiar with the flower ones, but then also you, I remember when you brought in like the sea creatures and, and the jellyfish and all of that, they just take on with these components. They just take on such an ethereal look. It's just, they're so beautiful. So
thank you. They do.
So was that your, did you kind of develop that on your own, or how did that come about? It's just so unique.
Yes and no. What we've done, we did develop all on our own, pretty much. I did take a class or two, but it was in a different direction from what we're doing, and none of that stuck. But we pursued the thin fusing because I've always been intrigued by thin glass. Chihuly's basket series that really made his mark in the early 70s was stunning and striking and just ethereal. And since then, I've always been fascinated with thin glass, so I started to apply that in making the lamps. And we've achieved a pretty good system of making just featherweight lamps that, you know, you don't think of the attraction to a lamp of being its weight, but for me it is. When I lift one of the thin ones up, they're just almost weightless. They're a joy for me.
Visually as well, where the stained glass is very heavy looking, beautiful, but heavy looking. Your lampshades with this thin glass, it's just so exquisite.
Yes. Fusing glass wants to be a quarter inch thick when it's molten. So that's the thickness that most fusing is done because it's quite handy. It doesn't change shape on you, so on and so forth. Our work can change shape quite a bit because the glass, if you keep it hot, it will continually contract until it's a quarter inch thick. So I'm working sometimes at a 16th of an inch thick, and it doesn't want to stay there. So we have to be careful how we modulate the temperatures on it. As a result of that, too, there are often a lot of perforations in the work, which actually for lamps turns out to be kind of a neat feature because as you move across the shade and you're looking at it, sparkles of light occur and then disappear where the holes are. And it adds a whole nother dimension to the work.
Especially when you see the shadows of it, you know, because we'd have them lit in the gallery and the shadows created are equally as beautiful.
Yes, thank you. You know, pursued that technique and I've the last few years started to teach it at various locations to a variety of students from the Retail Association to just people on their own who are doing craft work in their homes.
So tell us about the process of developing a piece. You work from a sketch or you have something in your mind or, you know, like from the origin of the piece to like the finished product. So take us through that.
Well, I do work from some sketches. But primarily, I like to work best at just very, very freelance. Very just sometimes I will literally scatter the components, which we make from the powder, say flower petals, stems, brackets, just scatter them on a table and see what happens and see what it sparks. And very often, because I experiment continually, and as a result, have a lot of failures, a lot of broken pieces and things that didn't work. But when it does work, that's what really gets me going and leads me into a new direction. And that often leads into some really, really wonderful effects. And again, it's the newness of it for me. It's the new invention, the new creation, something different than I've done before, and often very different than anybody's done before, because it just, you know, it's unique. I think almost all artists will tell you that their favorite and best pieces are surprises or accidents and something that led them, that sparked them to really bring out their creativity. And I'm finding that the older I get, the more I'm able to follow that course and not decide I'm going to make this and it's going to look like this. And I start making it and I finish it and it's done and it's that. But it's not as good as the stuff that comes out by surprise or through intentional
intuition. You just intuitively know where it should go in the moment.
Yeah, kind of. I'm sure you've had this experience, Esther, as an artist. And Larry, I don't know your background, so I don't know if you've done much artwork or not. But any artist that has gotten anywhere with their work will tell you that the surprises are the best part of it. They really do it. Two approaches to art. One being that you decide what you're going to make and what it's going to look like, and you attempt to do that, and you have success or you are not so successful, whatever. And the other method is to work by process, that you just start applying paint to a canvas or powders to a kiln sheet, and you start moving them around, and something happens that you see something that wasn't there before, and that leads you into a new direction, and you try and pursue that as openly as possible without preconceiving where it's going to take you, and then let it finally work until you either get to the finish line or you surpass that and overwork it and can never get back.
That 1 second move just changed the whole dynamic.
Yes. And when you're working with a lot of the things we do, like powders and stuff, once you mix them, that's it. You're stuck right there.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, on WVLP, 103.1 FM. I was looking at a piece that really struck me, and they're almost, I won't quite say photorealistic, but they almost look like there are photos playing on the glass, especially the shades. The one I'm looking at right now is the one on the pine cones hanging from the tree with the blue background. I mean, that looks like it'd almost be a photo transplanted onto that shade. I mean, that's, to me, that process is really amazing.
That series is quite realistic, and that was the start of thin fusing, the pine cone period. We have worked, as I look back on it, the pine cone period lasted, I'd say, a year and a half or so. As you mentioned, the undersea life, Esther, that we spent several years just doing jellyfish and anemones and various other sea creatures and call them water forms.
Right. Well, so what was the spark, Tom, for those sort of Victorian underglass sculptures that you were doing?
The bell jars.
Yes, the bell jars.
That came from the underwater series. During those 2 years, we kept doing them, and we were mounting them on black glass in the manner that you often see in books from the 1800s, where the biological specimens are shown in full, and then next to them are their components, the petals, the stems, the brackets.
Right.
It's a breakdown of the plant just to kind of show how it operates and what it is. And we mounted a lot of our pieces in that format. And then the more we did of that, the more I thought, well, boy, I'd like to do this three-dimensionally, but you can't do that heating up the glass because it becomes soft and plastic and it'll turn into a glob. So at that time also, I became exposed to the Chicago Mosaic School, which is a wonderful institution that does very contemporary modern work in the fashion, in the method of the oldest mosaics. And it's really a wonderful school, and they taught me to work with adhesives a bit. So I applied that technique and modified the adhesives to epoxies rather than mortars or grouts. And we started using epoxies to mount these very, very delicate forms into these, basically are what you would think of as a chunk of a reef, a tropical reef. Just pick up a chunk of that, if you could, and put it in a jar, and there it is. And it's got all of these different colors of coral and little critters and all sorts of things going on in it that make it very, very interesting. And you kind of wonder, how do you ever get that to stay together? But epoxy will do that. It's the greatest adhesive known.
Yeah, the transparency and delicacy just are so beautiful together. So however you turn it or look at it, you're getting different colorways and different
shapes. Yes, thank you.
Shapes.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of your dioramas right now, and the delicacy of the work is just absolutely amazing. It's like you've captured like it looks like it is in water, even though it isn't, and it's very yes. delicate and everything.
And handling that and getting it, you have to hold it in place for a bit. You know, if you saw one under construction, you'd see a lot of little tissue papers and such stuffed in between pieces that are keeping them in place before the epoxy sets up.
Is there a project that you haven't done, like a subject, so I'll say, is using your technique, some concept that you haven't done that you want to do?
Not that I can identify precisely, but I do work in these sort of periods. I've left glass for a couple of years at a time to do paintings or weaving or other such things. And then I get back to it. It's just how my mind works. I bounce around a lot, and I have a lot of interests that pull me in different directions. And I can see it in my work. A lot of my work is reflective of what I experience in my art. A lot of my work is very dense, a lot of leaves and background and objects and things that you can't quite identify, because a lot of times I'll see something in the yard and think it's a bird or an animal or something, and it's just a group of leaves that happen to be in that shape and are getting the right light on them to look like something else. So right now my mind is on skies quite a bit, has been for the last year or so, and I'm using them skies differently in my work. At the very moment, it's a lot of it is skies in gold, which is working out really well for me. We have a show set up now at Local Color Gallery in Union Pier. There was an event up there called Art Attack a week or two ago, and we were displayed in Local Color, fortunately in our own room with other artwork, where we were able to be in a room where we could shut out the lights. And you could really see the lamps in a way that you never see them for the most part in galleries or places, because it's daylight and they just don't light up like they do in a dark room. So one of our little tricks with it was we would leave the lights on so people were looking at the other art or whatever, and when they would begin to notice the lamps, we'd engage them and then shut off the light, and that would often get a audible response.
Yeah, ooh.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. So we're leaving the display up there indefinitely, because it's such a good way to show the work. And I don't get that opportunity that often.
Grandkids, are they sports grandkids or art grandkids?
But they're everything. They're across the board. But I'm glad you mentioned that, because just yesterday, my son Colin brought Chloe and Lily down, his two daughters, 3 and 5. And they saw some of our reef panels, and they really liked them. So we work in circles a lot, black glass circles, And Twyla makes these beautiful reef sections that are similar to the bell jars. They were the predecessors. And the kids loved them. So I got two glass circles out and turned them loose with all of the components. And what we just this morning put one of the reefs into the kiln to fire. So they'll have it. And they actually did a surprisingly good job, having never done it before, but they really took a good hard look at what Twyla had done with her reefs, and they got it. If you saw what they put together, you'd be, I think, as surprised as I am. I would never have guessed they would have gotten as adventurous with it as they did. They were piling stuff on, one on top of the other, and really building a reef. And being picky about it. They'd look at a tray of components and, you know, and then they'd take the tweezers and grab one and put it on and move it around. And they were being very considerate about what they were doing. That was a really treat. And Colin was watching and my wife and I were watching, and it was a great time.
Well, Tom, we have to wrap it up here. Very quickly, tell us how people can find you on your website.
Well, our website is, you know, sorrelessglassstudio.com, and we use it. We don't sell on our website. We use it as an archive, and we try and put as many pieces on there as possible.
We appreciate you coming on Art in the Air, sharing. That's Tom Sorreless. You can find him at sorrelessglassstudio.com, and you can explore the wonderful world that he's created on there. Tom, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your art journey.
Thank you, Larry and Esther. I really appreciate the opportunity.
It was a complete joy. Thank you, Tom.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell it to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air. We rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show